Attention staff and students, this is your principal with your daily update. The Satanic Study Hall podcast is not affiliated with any other podcast or organization. None. Zero. The views and opinions expressed on the podcast are ours and ours alone. Hail Satan!
Let us stand firm against any and all arbitrary authority that threatens the personal sovereignty of one or all. That which will not bend must break, and that which can be destroyed by truth should never be spared its demise. It is done. Hail Satan.
Welcome, everybody. Class is in fucking session. Welcome to another special edition of Satanic Study Hall here at the Kick-Ass Satanic Estate. We are live here at virtual headquarters, also on Twitch. My name is Bill. I am a member of the Satanic Temple and also a member of Love City Satanists. And today, I am joined by these degenerates here.
I am Veronica, the valedictorian of Study Hall, with the exception of tonight. It's actually becoming the exception every night, but I am the smartest person sometimes in Study Hall, and I am heavily aligned with the seven tenets of the Satanic Temple.
Hi, my name is Dennis Morningstar, and I'm also a member of the Satanic Temple.
Hello, everyone. I am Father Al. Bless you, my children. And I am also a member of the Satanic Temple.
So again, once again, thank you all for being here. This is fucking exciting. I know it's late. Some of us have work in the morning, but this celebration in virtual headquarters is absolutely fucking worth it. So what is Satanic Study Hall? If you're not familiar with what we do or who we are a podcast. Right now we're kind of a video podcast, but Satanic Study Hall is who we are, and we feature a rotating bench of degenerates and members of the Satanic Temple who discuss all things Satanism, from music to movies to news to books, art, folklore, pop culture, the list goes on. And anywhere else where good old Satan may pop his demonic head up and say hello. Satanic Study Hall has been on the air since July of 2020. We have covered such topics as the Church of Satan, TST basics, depression and addiction. We featured listeners and supporters' personal journeys, covered normie Satanism, hypocrisy in the Catholic Church, and a lot more. At the last Satanic Estate gathering, we spent a night with author and folklore enthusiast Matt Lake. Yes, Matt was awesome. It was a kick-ass time. We discussed Krampus and all the associated dark folklore and just had a great time doing it.
Everything us nerds care about.
So here we are. We are back. And we would also like to formally welcome Mr. Dennis Morningstar to virtual headquarters, who wasn't with us last time. Dennis runs our Instagram and Discord server and is an OG host of Satanic Study Hall alongside Johnny and I. So welcome, Dennis. It's great to have you.
Thanks. It's finally good to be on one of the virtual headquarters. I'm sad that I missed the first one, but you know, I was in the chat cheering you guys on, giving you shit mostly, but
speaking of giving us shit, I heard Principal Pans in the fucking chat room again. I apologize in advance for any bullshit that might fly through his fingers and through his keyboard.
Don't worry, I'm sure there's a little present for him.
He is an astute disciplinarian.
Yeah. So what we like to do here before we get started, a little bit of a warm-up exercise for us, is kind of go around the room and kind of, you know, catch up a little bit. We've recently coined this segment of the podcast, How Are You Now? Because I fucking love Letterkenny. You'll see that as this presentation progresses. So we'll start with you, Mr. Morningstar. How are you now?
I'm doing well. All right. Remember the first episode I came back on, I told you that my pipes burst like two different times in a row. Like I got them fixed and then they burst again. It happened again. So it's like three times in 7 or 8 days now. It's great.
Ouch.
Are you doing this work yourself or what?
No. Like a tub of that Flex Seal shit.
Right. Slap that shit on. Just fucking go to town. No, I've hired three different fucking people and gone to shit. But other than that, I'm doing really fucking well.
Good to hear. Glad to have you here. Father Al, how are you now?
I'm doing a lot better than I was earlier. Man, I was high as fuck thanks to Mr. Morningstar. Gotta watch out for that guy.
Yeah, I'm glad there was like 5 hours in between you hitting that bowl and us going live.
It'd be more of a drooling vegetable than usual.
Oh, God.
That was some good shit.
Devil's lettuce.
Any interesting stories coming out of the confessional, Father Al?
None yet. That is a... that's a challenge out there for anyone who wants to send in any good confessional stories. We'd love to read them.
Yes, our DMs are always open. Just slide on in.
Slide on in.
Veronica, how are you now?
I'm great. Like as you guys know, in the next, like very recently, or not recently, in the immediate future, I'm going through a huge kind of life transition, but it's going to be for the better. And every single one of you has helped me out through that. So, you know, very grateful.
Fuck yes.
Also, welcome. Valentine's Day is coming up. Not all of us are very enthusiastic about Valentine's Day, but I'm enthusiastic about Galentine's Day. So I'm going to see some of the girls that I haven't seen since the first wave of lockdowns, you know, kind of took over our lives. So that's going to be really fun. I'm in a really good mood.
So I guess it's my turn.
Yes.
All right. Bill, how are you now? Good and you, not so bad. All right, we're done. Moving on. Awesome. Once again, I know I've said this twice now, but we're live and I'm kind of repeating myself. Thank you, everybody who was here. I see the numbers kind of growing on Twitch, numbers growing in virtual headquarters. This is opening fucking night. We were watching Adam and the Tofu earlier at 8 o'clock in the kitchen. A lot of good stuff going on at virtual headquarters. The lineup for 5 days is pretty fucking impressive. We will be keeping an eye on the chat room. Not going to commit to a Q&A because we have a pretty long journey with Dr. Eric Sprankle coming up. But if we have time, we'll definitely dive in. So if you have anything to talk or any questions to say or ask, put them in the chat room and we will address them if we have time. Now, our title for this presentation is Sex Ed Room 666, or I guess we could say Sex Ed for Satanists. First, we will dive, before we get into all that stuff and talk to Dr. Eric Sprankle, we're going to dive down the Lupercalia rabbit hole a little. Well, all right. So you're going to hear me say Lupercalia, Lupercalia. Veronica made up her own little word. She calls it Lupercana.
Exactly. And you know what? Hexacana is right around the fucking corner. Yes,
but so it's all the same thing. So yeah, I'm going to switch it up.
I'm waiting for Holocana.
Let's just call it the wonderful day.
The wonderful day.
The wonderful day.
So first, we're going to dive down the Lupercalia wonderful day rabbit hole. And learn about the history, how the festival and celebration ended up being or kind of evolving into whatever this love fest of Valentine's Day that goes on in today's world. Our Lupercalia coverage will start with the history and then end on the topic of fertility and sex, which will be a perfect lead-in to our featured guest, as we mentioned before. Dr. Eric Sprankle is stopping by Study Hall. Eric Sprankle is an associate professor of clinical psychology and co-director of the sexuality studies program at Minnesota State University. He is a licensed clinical psychologist and is an AASECT certified sex therapist. Not sure if I'm supposed to pronounce those letters, but I'm just going to stick with the acronym. Affiliated with the Minnesota Sexual Health Institute. Dr. Sprankle will discuss sexual health, sexual liberty, and answer a mixture of questions from us, as well as questions farmed from our goat farm, which is our two social media communities that we have on Facebook and Discord. Now, one more thing too, something new we are trying for this VHQ presentation is a quiz that can be filled out as we present and submitted for when we're done. Now, quizzes scoring 100%. You have to get every question right. Might have some runner-up prizes if depending on the curve. But Principal Pan says all quizzes have to be submitted by 1 a.m. at the latest, and all qualified entries will be entered to win a free month subscription to our Patreon, Satanic Study All t-shirt, and a pretty cool Lupercalia print that our valedictorian came up with.
Thanks.
More details on our social media. Now, in the next 10, 15 minutes or so, Principal Pan, if he's not busy throwing someone's ass in detention. We'll drop the link to the survey quiz. It's going to come up in the form of a survey. So open up a separate tab in your browser, fill it out as we go, and see if you could win some cool Satanic Study Hall merchandise.
Nice.
Fucking right. Fuckers. So before we had a little bit more business to handle, before we get started, we want to let everyone know how to follow and support the podcast on social media and beyond. First, you can like us on Facebook. We fucking hate Facebook, but when you're in this forum of entertainment and media, it's kind of essential to an extent. So you can find us at Satanic Study Hall. Same with our Instagram. We talked about our goat farm, which is called Satanic Study Hall Presents the Goat Farm. There you can interact with the cast of Satanic Study Hall, as well as all of the guests we featured and all the other listeners and supporters. On Twitter, we can be found at Satanic SH. You know where we are on Twitch if you're here via there or on the Satanic Estate. And Principal Pan is also going to drop a link in both the VHQ and Twitch chats. If he fucking forgets, we'll put it on our social media with a link to join our Discord server. Discord, for lack of better words, is popping. We're having a great time. And Dennis has put a great deal of time into keeping our eyes and focused. Shout out to Darren and Kat and everybody else who's been really instrumental in helping keep this together. It's a lot of fun. Now, last but not least, for a little cheap plug, you can consider supporting our podcast and all of our degenerative efforts at patreon.com/satanicstudyhall, where we have three membership or levels of support, one being 333, 1666, and the other, as I like to call it, the super fucking satanic VIP level. Gets you a one-on-one Zoom meeting with the cast, the shirt, a bunch of cool shit. And before we move forward, I do want to shout out our friends over at Misty's Coventry. That's M-H-I-S-T-Y-S Coventry. A lot of cool occult and satanic merchandise coming out of there. You can search them on eBay or on any outlet on social media and they'll pop up. Misty's Coventry has been a supporter of Satanic Study Hall from the get-go. We love everybody over there. Definitely check them out. And one big giant shout out to our friend Rhett over at Dark Art Depository. You can check out all the cool shit he's doing at darkartdepository.com. Constantly updating his styles and designs and his clothing line, a lot of original artwork. So definitely support, you know, local artists, local businesses, support your fellow Satanists and all the cool initiatives that are going on within our community. That's a mouthful. That's
very
what she
good
said.
Mouthful.
I always wait for my office reference. Now, as always, the quickest way to get our attention is to send us an email at satanicstudyhall.com or give us a 1-star Apple podcast review. And we'll definitely respond to that relatively quickly. Now, while we have a good deal of fans, I'm looking on Twitch, or we have, you know, almost 85, 90 people, whatever's going on in VHQ. We also have some haters, but our haters make us laugh. Now, on the topic of haters, I'm kind of surprised nobody has tried to kidnap us and leave us in a basket to die on the Tiber River, like poor Romulus and Remus.
Wait, that hasn't happened to any of you guys yet? What?
I should have prefaced this with letting everybody know we found Veronica the Valedictorian in a basket on the Schuylkill River outside of Philadelphia.
Right, suckling a radioactive wolf.
Yes, absolutely.
Suckling a bottle of Yards beer.
God damn it.
Rumple mints. Yes. Now, speaking of Romulus and Remus, what better time? Business is handled. Let's get down to business. We're 15 minutes in. Let's start talking about Lupercalia and learn a little bit about what's going on with this holiday.
All right, everyone. Let's dive down the Lupercalia rabbit hole. The ancient festival of Lupercalia is held each year on February 15th. Modern Valentine's Day borrows its name from a martyred saint, but historically it might have evolved from Lupercalia, which may date back as far as the 600 BC. The Roman holiday was violent, sexual, and full of animal sacrifice in order to fend off malicious spirits and infertility. While many say that Lupercalia is borrowed from celebrations that also borrowed from others, that's how it works, right? It is associated with numerous deities, many Roman versions of Greek gods, and the infamous she-wolf, Lupa.
Oh, yeah. I was supposed to howl here. Ow! There we go. I totally missed that fucking cue.
Dennis,
whoops.
Dennis, it's your turn.
Wait, Lyle wants to howl too.
I'm not fucking doing it. That's how he howls.
I'm not fucking doing it.
Come on, Dennis. Howl. Howl.
I'm doing it.
Howl.
Oh. Now, speaking of wolves, I hear there's some wolves being featured at virtual headquarters for Lupercalia. I'm excited to check that out. Sorry to interrupt with the whole howling thing. Sorry, I forgot.
Nerd. You're starting to sound like the valedictorian. All right.
Sorry. Moving on.
All right. Lupercalia tells us the tale of Romulus and Remus, who are credited as being the twin founders of Rome. The twins were sent to their death by drowning by King Amulius, but were taken pity on by a local who put them in a basket to float down the Tiber River. After a brief trip on the Tiber River rapids, Romulus and Remus were met on a riverbank at the bottom of Palatine Hill by a rather enormous wolf known as Lupa.
Lupa.
Romulus and Remus were suckled and protected by Lupa the wolf until they were later taken in by a Roman shepherd named Faustulus and his wife Acca. Not too long after the boys matured, their true identity became known, and they achieved retribution towards their murderous uncle, killing him without hesitation.
I would do it too. Maybe.
We all would. After attaining retribution on their uncle King, Romulus and Remus were once again in their royal positions. At one point, the boys found the cave of their adolescent years and were nurtured by Lupa the Wolf. Because of its rich history and significance, the brothers dubbed the cave Lupercal, or the Wolf's Cave, and it became a sacred site along with the remains of the shepherd's hut. The Lupercal Cave would soon become host to the Lupercalia rituals and festivals. Other parts of the festival were celebrated on Palatine Hill and a public meeting place referred to as the Comitium.
So what exactly happened during the Lupercalia Festival? In our research, we learned that there was a great deal of misunderstandings and downright weird shit that went on, you know, February 14th and 15th.
Definitely.
Let's get weird.
Fucking crazy shit.
Only for $2 a month.
That's it? So we'll do our best to make sense of all, like, you know, the goat straps, sacrifices, puppies, street whippings.
Wait, not the puppies.
Yeah, fucking puppies, dude.
Yeah, the puppies really surprised me in the research. I thought it was just like a dog. Not that it makes a difference, but a fucking puppy.
Too many puppies.
Puppies. But the street whipping, what's your about
getting
that?
Getting shot in a I'm cool with the street whipping, but the fucking puppies.
You couldn't howl when you're singing?
Man, we should have had fucking Primus lined up for that shit.
I remember that song.
Right? So fucking good. It is said that Lupercalia exists to pay homage to the she-wolf Lupa and to please the Roman fertility god Luperca. On Lupercalia, it is in what is now known as Lupercalia Cave, two priests or the Luperci sacrificed a goat and a puppy. Yes,
not
a puppy.
The puppy.
Yes, a fucking puppy. The puppy sacrifice, much like the Roman traditions and gods, is believed to be stolen from the Greeks. The Greeks even had a word for this. Periskoulikissimoi, or purification by puppy.
I must say, you did a great fucking job. Not to interrupt, a great fucking job pronouncing that. I actually cut and paste that into Google to get them to pronounce it for me. I would have butchered it every time.
Dude, I sat here for like fucking 45 minutes practicing that.
We heard that word over and over and over again in practice.
Yes. No, dude, this is like what?
Well done.
What's the word that's not a vowel, a consonant? It's like 14 of them in a row.
Dennis has been paying attention in school lately.
I even learned what etymology was. Ooh. That was fucking crazy. Where I leave off. Fuck you.
You have to say the word again.
Sacrificing of puppies.
Oh, periskoulikissimoi. The sacrificing of puppies dates all the way back to the Chinese Shang dynasty. So after all the goat and puppies are sacrificed, blood from the goat and puppies are smeared on the forehead of two noble-born young men. Then the blood was wiped off their foreheads with wool that was saturated in milk. Now, it was apparent that it was very important for the young men to be laughing throughout the entire process, which is rather fucking odd.
Considering they're killing puppies.
That's right.
It's a little psychotic.
So it's baby Fido.
It's Rome.
Forced then, jovialness. Gotta put on a show, right?
I don't know. Then again, I laughed during that whole fucking scene in Midsummer when the two 72-year-old people fucking jumped off the cliff. So.
You would. You probably laughed at the end of The Mist, too, you sick bastard.
Oh, dude, that was an amazing fucking ending.
Cracking up during the Titanic.
After all the blood was cleaned from the wool, the young men would begin wrapping straps of the sacrificed goat hide around their body. And after all, they were all covered like sufficiently. It was time to eat. Really?
Time to eat.
Fucking everything that they slaughtered. Time to fucking eat.
You bring time to puppies. I am leaving this pot.
What did they eat, Dennis?
Well, this was the Feast of Lupercalia occurred. And the menu was fucking disgusting, dude. It had been said that the remains of the goat, like the intestines, the fucking entrails, they'd all be skewered and fucking cooked to, you know, to enjoy for all. This may have been also something that had to do with the fertility thing, but I'm not 100% on that. After everyone's bellies were nice and full of goat innards, it was then
the meal of champions.
Fucking innards.
Breakfast of champions. Right
you there. Get a portrait of yourself put on the wall. Yeah,
right? Get a t-shirt with that.
Definitely.
I went to Lupercalia and all I got was this fucking t-shirt. Right.
It's like Wing Bowl.
And E. coli.
Oh, you can leave with a pet tapeworm.
Oh, God. You're right.
It was then time for the running of the Lupercalia. Before the run began, two colleges were created to represent each of the twins, Romulus and Remus. These colleges were called Fabi for Remus or Quintuselli for Romulus. The Lupercalia would then continue their jovial behavior, but now running around the Palatine naked, hitting women who were awaiting their arrival with their goatskin thongs. I want to kind of see a goatskin thong. That sounds
just a fancy word for a strap.
Ah, oh, that's no fun.
A switch.
That's right. Yeah. Whitney, like Krampus.
Baby. Whitney. Yes.
Fucking wits. Mm. Calm down, Dennis. Focus. I know it's Lupercalia, but
the Lupercalia running through the streets have been referred to as nudus, untus, ebrius, naked, oiled, and drunk. The only two references to a reason for the naked thing was for speed, and the other being a tale of Romulus and Remus being interrupted during a ceremony and having to run their stolen or running after their stolen cattle naked.
Weird. I remember that. Yeah, that's fucking when like one of the village people came in and told them that, oh, someone's stealing all your cows. And then they
was
just
the cop.
The cop?
The village people?
No, it was one of the village people. Well, wow, I picked up on that quickly. I was like, wait a second.
No, but, I'm off guard. That was my fault. Yes.
So one of the villagers or one of the people at the festival, they came and so they came and were like, oh, Remus, someone's stealing your shit. So they bolted out of the Lupercalia celebration or the ritual and ran after their cattle naked, apparently.
Right. My mom's got cattle. I wonder how fun that is. I'll just get naked and run through their pen, just chasing them with like a fork and knife.
Like just for the hell of
old Looney Tunes cartoons. Fuck yeah.
Be sure to film it.
Yeah.
Right. And wild. Then we had to find another host for the podcast.
When you see, you already saw me do that busted video.
Oh, God.
They're so fucking good.
All right. Fuck Romulus and Remus. We're moving on to Julius Caesar. So this is Lupercalia when Julius Caesar was offered the crown. Julius Caesar actually added another college to the celebration called Julie, which did not last that long. And the holiday also bears a relation to the events of February 15th, 44 BCE, when Mark Antony, naked and inebriated, attempted to offer Caesar the crown and therein the keys to the kingdom. The Roman crowd met Caesar with praise when he refused the symbol of ultimate authority. It remains up for debate as to whether this was a stunt staged in order to gauge the Roman political climate at the time, or if it was just a simply kind of really dark, elaborate joke between friends. But regardless, Bill, oh, shit. I'm sorry. I meant Caesar. It's okay.
Was what are you doing?
Was stabbed to death a month later by his loyal co-hosts. Oh, shit. I meant senators. He had senators. Senator's not a co-host. I'm so
what's
silly.
Going on?
All right. Bill, I got to be honest with you. In history class, I got a little bit inspired by this particular story. So me and the boys chipped in for a little present for you. So you see that thing on your desk? What's on your desk, Bill?
Well, I'm looking at a packed bowl of some fine indica right now.
No, what's the other I'm thing jealous. On your desk, Bill? What's the other thing?
The thing with the index card attached to it that says wait for Lupercalia? It's a laurel wreath.
What, Bill?
A laurel wreath.
Hey, Bill. Put on the wreath, Bill.
I knew you were into this shit. What? No.
Crown yourself Satanic Caesar, William.
Wait, me? Satanic Caesar?
Do it.
Fuck yeah, all right. All right, so this is what she's talking about? This thing right here? Oh, man, it's all tangled up. I'm going to put it on anyways.
All right. Boo!
Fuck y'all, I'm Caesar. All. Shut up, you mutinous little bastards. You like that?
Okay, sorry. Okay. All right. Anyway.
All right.
Continue.
I'm gonna. Do I have to wear this the whole presentation?
Yes.
Or just for whatever you're doing?
You do, Caesar.
For right. as long as you.
For last. Another month.
Let me look in the camera. fuck. All right. Whatever. Yeah. Fuck all that. All right. Speaking of Caesar, now that y'all got that out of your system.
It's not out of our system yet. You got a month.
It's not in your system yet.
That shit runs through my system. Weird.
Oh my God. All right.
Are we done with Caesar?
No, we're not.
Caesar's I'm not done with Caesar. So all this talk about Caesar. Let's talk about Caesar.
You said you had a devil's dictionary for us or something.
No, this is not a devil's dictionary. I just want to know if y'all know what a creamy Caesar is.
Oh no.
The dressing.
If you have children in the room, listeners, cover their ears. They shouldn't be fucking near this
dressing, right?
Computer anyways. So a creamy Caesar is when you're having sex doggy style. And right before you come, you stab your partner in the back, come in the hole.
My ex fiance tried to do that to me reverse. Stab me in the gut.
I'm sorry. I've waited for that this whole time. Like I've held the creamy Caesar joke in for long enough.
You know what?
I hope they invite us back to virtual headquarters after that.
Forget you guys. You beat my joke. Yeah. You know what? We're going to talk about the lame ass love fest.
Hashtag creamy Caesar.
We're going to talk about the lame ass.
Delicious.
The lame ass love fest. All right, everybody. Jesus Christ. We're going on to Valentine's Day, the most valuable holiday, or at least it starts with a V, which is the best letter, in my opinion. So it has been asserted that Lupercalia was directly replaced by the Vatican, another V word, with the Feast of St. Valentine, though many historical experts agree there is no tangible evidence to support this. It's more likely that the modern Valentine's Day and the love aspect was annexed in the 14th century as a result of the Parliament of Fowls, a poem by Geoffrey Chaucer. After the poem came, the day we're all too fortunate enough to recognize as Valentine's Day. Even now, there is a discrepancy between which Valentine Chaucer truly referenced, be it Valentine of Genoa, whose feast falls in early May, or Valentine of Rome, and all historically associated February fertility festivals say it three times fast.
February fertility festival, February fertility festival, February fertility festival.
You know what? I'm proud of you. I can't even.
That's right.
I'm proud of you. Lupercalia included. Whatever the case, it seems Rome won out, as both commercialized Valentine's Day and our satanic Lupercalia are not held in the month of May. Are they, boys?
No.
Nope.
Nope.
All right. The church and the evolution of Lupercalia. In the times of polytheism, it is suggested that many gods bore associations with the holiday. A few of these being Mars, Juno, Lupercus, Lycaeus, Bacchus, Februs, and even Pan. Yes, even that
Pan.
The filthy principle of ours was probably one of the designated gods of Lupercalia. Much like our demonic goatman Baphomet, again, our principal's namesake, Pan, is the Greek equivalent of the Roman Faunus. He has the rear, the legs, and the horns of a goat. This is getting horny.
The principle of fucking panic.
That is actually where the word panic comes from.
Good sure job. Is.
Much like a faun or satyr, he is classified as the god of fields, groves, glens, woodlands, and best of all, sex. But those were the good old days, unfortunately. Because then came the Dark Ages and Christianity and stuff. Post-AD depictions of Lupercalia show women flagellated painfully rather than hit lightly during jubilation. Traditions of the cult of Cybele, as one example, illustrate the evolutionary popularity of flagellation, even to a point of fatality. Among the growing religious populace of the time. In the coming centuries, the act of spiritual purification by scourging among monastic communities is isolated fanatic groups became commonplace. Despite Lupercalia's pagan history, its whipping aspect seemed to ripen for assimilation and modification in the ages of Abrahamic martyrdom, which did get pretty bloody, as we're all very much aware. Even in Rome, sacrifice was eventually prohibited by 341 AD, yet Lupercalia carried on beyond this date, especially in Constantinople. In the Ottomans...
It's Istanbul, not Constantinople.
Yeah, right, whatever.
Why did Constantinople get the works?
Why?
It's nobody's business but the Turks.
Ooh.
You know, wow. a little interesting fact. Who did that song? Was it They Might Be Giants? Istanbul, like Constantinople. I can't remember, but if it was They Might Be Giants is the fucking theme to Mickey Mouse Clubhouse. The things you learn as a father of a child.
Did
yeah.
you do that shit?
Yeah. Mickey Mouse. Yeah, I'm not singing that shit. All right, see, moving
the
on.
The only song I know by was that fucking The Lighthouse song.
But just remember.
The one about the fucking nightlight.
God, I don't even know. The
lighthouse in your soul or some shit like that. This song's fucking awesome. Check that one out.
The things you learn as a father, the things you learn in study hall.
That's right.
In the dregs of the Western Empire, however, early popes commentated on Lupercalia's stark degeneration and officially ended the celebration entirely, claiming it had not been performed appropriately or for its appropriate reason in quite some time.
All right. Now, celebrating Lupercalia today. Like many traditional holidays of antiquity, Lupercalia poses a challenge for modern people who wish to celebrate it. If conducted today, many of the activities common in Rome would result in imprisonment or fines. Engage in bizarre civil disobediences at your own risk, or find ways of adapting. To do this, one has to define what the original spirit was based on in combination with what it might translate to today. Those extremely enamored by Roman culture can continue paying homage to the founders of the empire. We personally wouldn't give thanks to anyone besides our Dark Lord Satan, but who you all choose to worship while you're naked is none of our business.
If you like- it really isn't. You don't have to tell us.
Does anybody else do the Buffalo Bill when you're in front of the mirror naked?
God damn it. We just said anybody? They didn't have to tell us.
I'll gladly admit to this shit. Every time I get out of the shower, I pull that fucking shit. Every time, guaranteed. Especially if there's somebody around.
Would you fuck them? I'd fuck them.
Oh my God.
So if you'd like to take this naked worship outside, beware of the authorities, disapproving neighbors, Dennis, Veronica, Bill, Johnny.
Mostly me, yeah.
Me. And the occasional freak snowstorm.
Yeah, thanks, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Answering the call of the wolf instead of sacrificing animals. Sacrifice some funds or resources for a particular conservation or habitat project that you like.
Definitely. You all see those wolves, those bats, and everything else we have in the satanic estate. So definitely, you know, support something and support an animal that means a lot to you.
There's really a wolf on our chalkboard right now. Someone tried erasing it, but they suck.
Really?
So anybody else can see it, yeah. We got a couple of Easter eggs on our chalkboard if any of y'all want to, I don't know.
Try to spot them.
Yeah, there's like six or seven of them. We were bored one day.
Damn it, I wasn't there for that one. Anyway, brace the wild if you fancy. Observing creatures that still live naturally, or spend some quality time celebrating your fluffy little family members. As without wolves, your loving companions might not have come to be at all. There's definitely a brotherhood aspect to Lupercalia that can be capitalized on. Here in America, we obviously gather for, early February football event. And, why not let that spirit and enthusiasm be revived on Lupercalia? Even if you can't congregate in a cave, get together virtually, social distance, whatever, you know, stand across a fucking football field from each other to toast the brothers, both of blood and friendship. Smoke a bowl in brotherhood, if doth so please.
If it doth so please of thee.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. And if none of these interest you, you can always go get a few of the guys together and go join the Church of Satan's Warlock Academy. Because for only $666 annually, you can elitely partake in the utmost elite of all elite brotherhoods. No girls allowed.
And why the fuck wouldn't you want to become a satanic gentleman?
And I am on the fast track for that shit. Let me tell you. I'm doubling my pay. Doing it twice a year. Let's do this. Right.
Dennis, you're the most satanic gentleman we have in the
farm. Magistar Magic Johnson will tell you all about it.
Magistar Magic Johnson.
Moving on.
I'm so sorry. The story of Rome goes, when a villain deprived two children of the guardians, the gods conspired to give them a noble and worthy substitute. Reflect on this during Lupercalia. Where have we all found the alternatives in unexpected places? Has there ever been someone who became the difference between life and death? You know, maybe partake in a personal ritual of thanks for all these rare moments and these rare people. You know, while ideating tangible ways to pay deep kindness forward.
Your voice got all deep and serious for a second. Oof. Well,
it might be
goosebumps, Dennis.
Never mind.
While ideating.
I know. Don't even start with that fucking word. I told her she had the right shit for a 5-year-old and she gives me that fucking word.
What crazy sociopath ideates the word ideation?
I'm so glad this next section is so adult and professional. All right, thanks, so for anyone who still enjoys a good whipping or thwacking, go for it, consensually. It's very important not to thwack anyone without consent, especially pregnant women. But maybe you can find one who will appreciate the fertility blessing and aims to conceive a crotch monster. Cook up some goat dinners. Or, if you're a vegetarian, maybe Adam the Satanic Chef has some plant-based recipes you can prepare. After all, Lupercalli is about the celebration of sex and sexual liberation, whether that means making love to your heart's content or choosing not to make love at all. Eat well, and make sure to get your fill of whatever expression love makes the most means the most to you. Tell thyself, happy Lupercalli.
Can I just jump in real fast? He's a crotch monster.
It just
reminds me of something that someone pointed out to me the other day, and in my fucking entire existence of watching SpongeBob, I have never realized that Mr. Krabs lives in Bikini Bottom.
Oh, right? No. Yes.
Ruined my fucking childhood.
Ooh, I'm going to try to recover from that. Now, with that being said, Lupercalia rabbit hole, we've climbed out of that sumbitch. It's time to dive into sex ed room 666. So let's all get our shit together, head on down the hallway, enter room 666, and have a conversation with Dr. Sprankle. And Dr. Sprankle offers a great deal of perspective and knowledge on the topics of sexual health, liberation, alternative sexual lifestyles, and how to fucking make sense of all this as a Satanist. I know in virtual headquarters on Twitch, anybody watching this, we're all over the spectrum when it comes to longevity and Satanism. Some of us have been around, not me, but some of you have been around since the inception of TST 2013. Before that experience with Church of Satan or other variations of Satanism, there's some people that have immersed themselves in this community 2 days ago. And that's one thing we definitely want to do at Satanic Study Hall when we have these guests, is ask a lot of questions and fucking learn. But we're not always serious. Sometimes we go off on tangents. Sometimes we talk about shit that has absolutely nothing to do with the topic we're trying to cover. I mean, hell, I'm looking at my notes and it says that we might even talk about butt stuff, which is, I don't know who wrote that, which is right up Dennis's alley. So Dennis, do you have any,
I've got plenty thing of stuff on butt stuff? I've got plenty of stuff to talk about butt stuff. Now, I just wanted to know, first off, when you put in Denny's alley, were you going somewhere with that?
No, that just happened. That just happened to go that way.
Just wanted to know.
I've known that you've been a fan of.
Yeah, I mean, I personally, I don't know. I can remember the first time this shit ever happened. My ex was pissed at me, and she wanted to get back at me. She thought just shoving a finger up there one time would do it. I must have sprung 3 feet off the bed. God damn it! I fucking love it. Holy shit!
So this is how this is going to work. Now, we had the opportunity to sit down and have an in-depth conversation with Eric Sprankle in a pre-recorded interview. Now, this panel of degenerates that you're looking at right now will introduce a question that we posed to him. We'll review his answer, and then we'll discuss it as a group. So outside of some of the highlights of Dr. Eric Sprankle's career that I mentioned before, some of his research areas are understanding the impact of stigma on marginalized sexual communities, examining therapist biases against folks with stigmatized identities, studying the relationships between Satanism, stigma, and mental health. Dr. Sprankle is also known for his works as the paper that I just mentioned in the research study and the virtual paper that was presented at the Midwestern Conference on Professional Psychology in 2020. I butchered that. Satanism, Stigma, and Mental Health. It's a two-part series on TST TV, and it was featured at the Midwestern Conference on Professional Psychology in 2020. There, I had to fix that. Sex Affirmative Therapy, Conceptualization and Case Study 2019. And he also did a research study called Swipe Left on the Bi Guys, examining attitudes toward dating and being sexual with bisexual individuals. And that was published in the Journal of Bisexuality in 2019. So without wasting any more time, let's get started and get to know our featured guest. Dr. Sprankle is going to go over a bit about who he is, a little bit of a history with religion, path to Satanism, and a little bit more. So hopefully that bio covered everything. But with that being said, welcome, Eric.
Yeah, I mean, other than stressed, I would say that bio is pretty much my life. It's work and all of that I do at Minnesota State and the Department of Psychology and the research and the education that I do and the outreach. And then my other side is just playing with my three tabby cats and trying to get them to get along. To our sisters, and they're bonded, obviously, since birth. But we brought in a stray about a year ago, and so that's been a full-time job trying to integrate them slowly and peacefully, and it hasn't been peacefully. So there's a lot of separations and management and supervision. But yeah, that's my life. A lot of sexuality studies and supervising three tabby cats. Pandemic has kind of limited what we're able to do, but finding new joys and puzzles and bird watching and everything else older adults enjoy. So that's been at least somewhat pleasurable to pass the time. I watch two different types of reality shows. One is the whole Bachelor Nation series. And so Bachelorette and Bachelor. So Bachelor is going on right now. So that's been fun. But also the other one is 90 Day Fiancé. And I'm just fascinated with that. If you don't know, it's on TLC.
Okay.
And they have like 20 different spinoffs of that same concept. And yeah, just to watch it from like, it's a little bit of veg out, but also kind of analytical of, you know, just assessing different people's relationships and their communication styles and knowing which couples are doomed from the get-go, whereas others like, man, this could work. They just need to do X, Y, or Z. So I guess that's not technically turning off work mode, but it's still enjoyable because I don't have a personal investment.
That was just going to say that. I was gonna be like, yeah, not personally invested in that stuff. You can kind of lay back and then watch it kind of all unfold in front of your eyes and exactly. Not feel any guilt down the road if it doesn't happen to, you know, work out.
Right. Yeah, so I grew up Catholic and...
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I get that a lot. And that's usually what I say as a euphemism. If you don't want to disclose atheism or Satanism, or if someone asks what your religion is, it's, I grew up Catholic. And then it's just kind of assumed that you're no longer that you fell off at some point. But I would say that, you know, my background in Catholicism is nothing unique. We're certainly more just culturally Catholic. I would say just kind of go through the motions kind of Catholic. We did a little quick prayer before dinner time. We had Sunday mass. I had to go to what's called CCD. If you don't know what that is within Catholicism, if you didn't go to Catholic school and you went to public school, the public school kids had to go to Catholic school one night a week. So it was essentially like Sunday school, but it was like a Wednesday evening or something. So just more school, more church. Went through all the sacraments, all of that. But it was just very behavioral. It was very procedural. It had no real like deep like faith meaning to me. So when I got older in my adolescence, it was pretty easy to drop. And because I went to public school and it wasn't like in an insulated kind of evangelical community that here a lot of people are, that transition from like being a believer within Catholicism to at least atheism in high school, that was a pretty seamless transition. I didn't like lose friends. My parents didn't really care all that much. They did care when I started turning like my Catholic crucifix in my room upside down. And wearing like white zombie t-shirts that said, "Say you love Satan" on the back of it, that they kind of pumped the brakes on a little bit. But otherwise, my disbelief really didn't change my life in any significant way. Yeah, I think the intro to it, I remember, now this is like 20 plus years ago. So I remember having the Satanic Bible when I was in high school. And so this would have been mid to late 90s. And so internet was just becoming a thing. So I don't think I stumbled upon it online. So where I think I was introduced to the Church of Satan and then the Satanic Bible, I think I looked into it a little bit more and then went to like Walden's Books or whatever the bookstore was at the mall at that time. And then bought a copy of the Satanic Bible. So I think that was my introduction. So 16, 17 years old and via Church of Satan, because that was pretty much all that was around at that time in the 90s. And being critical of it didn't come until later and being exposed to different ideologies and philosophies and started seeing some problems with it. But yeah, I mean, at the time it was refreshing. I mean, it was the only kind of like religious text or religious authority that kind of had that viewpoint, especially the chapter on satanic sex. And it was just very permissive and permission granting. And you obviously didn't get that through Catholicism or other avenues within Christianity. So that was very refreshing to see and just kind of surprising to see. And I've always been into like satanic iconography and just like horror and goth culture since, you know, I was a little kid. And so that aspect of it was appealing. And at this time too, of just adolescent rebellion that kind of fit into like just a reactionary kind of response within Satanism. I think that's pretty common when people start dipping their toes in it a little bit. And then maybe a little bit later, maybe college, grad school, I started looking at, you know, the instructions for a black mass, but that was pretty performative and just for like shock value to do during like Halloween parties to scare like my Christian grad student peers or whatever. I would label myself more of a de facto Satanist. And I know LaVey used that term to describe people who existed pre-1960s. But I think it can still be used today of like, people who on paper fit the definition of a Satanist, they just don't maybe identify it with it themselves or it plays that much of a big of a role in their life. But nonetheless, just by fact alone, they are. That kind of fits me more. And so it's not like I wake up in the morning saying to myself, how can I be a better Satanist? And then try to live according to that. I just try to work on how can I be more authentic? And that authenticity just happens to align with Satanism. It was sophomore year in college. I was at the University of Cincinnati, close to where I grew up. And I just took a psychology of human sexuality class. It was a huge, large lecture hall, like 500 other students in there. And just the topics, it was like so much I didn't know about sexuality was presented, as well as everything that I thought I knew, where it was actually just based on either half truths or myths. And so just kind of correcting a lot of that false information that we gathered through K-12 education or lack thereof. And I was just really fascinated and hooked on the topic of studying sexuality and sex education. That point forward is like, this is going to be my career in some capacity, whether it's going to be the clinical route or the education route. I didn't quite know at that time, but definitely within that field. I think it's within any kind of teaching, whether it's in the classroom or I'm at conferences or doing like a training or something with other clinicians or whatever, that moment where I'm presenting information that has either the students or the, you know, the attendees think or view sexuality a little bit differently than they did before they came into that classroom or into that auditorium or that conference session or whatever. So that's always my goal. It's difficult to measure, but it's the goal of just kind of having them think differently and providing them a little bit of a, hopefully a broader perspective of what sexuality is and the diversity of it that exists much larger than what our personal sexuality is and that we tend to kind of get just wrapped up in. And when you can see kind of like that light bulb kind of go off of realizing like, oh, wow, there's this whole other world, much like the experience I had in my class when I was a sophomore in college, that's, I think, the most fulfilling and rewarding part of my job. I'd say surprised me, but also not surprised me in a way, has less to do with the results of any research or project that I've been involved in, and more just the planning of it and kind of the lit review that goes into before you start a study, before you design it, and just realizing how little information is out there, how little this topic has been studied. And that's true for most of the projects I've undertaken, whether it's within sex work stigma and sex worker affirmative therapy, or what I've been involved in more currently, looking at Satanist stigma and mental health and Satanist sexuality. I'm basically going off of nothing. I have to kind of pull in from other topic areas that could be comparable to even just kind of get a sense of like what we could expect to generate like research questions. If not, we can generate some hypotheses. But to give you an example of for the last two projects I've been working on with looking at Satanists, their experiences of stigma, discrimination, mental health, and sexuality. Within the psychological literature, nothing has really been written since the 1990s. And the bulk of that is just satanic panic stuff. So either looking at satanic ritual abuse, DID, recovered memories, all that kind of stuff, or psychiatrists or psychologists doing like a case report on some teenager who's a Satanist and they're in an inpatient unit and the psychiatrist thinks all their mental health problems are either a cause or a consequence because of their Satanism. And then so it's very sensationalized, even though it's within a peer-reviewed journal article. that's it. And I want to base my study on actual Satanists, self-identified Satanists, their experiences of stigma. And just that's never been done before. And so you kind of have to pull a little bit, maybe what's been done with atheists or pagans, but it could certainly be very unique for Satanists. So just kind of, again, not all that surprised that that is the case. But once you start doing the keyword searches in some of these research databases, still kind of being surprised that nothing is coming up. And the stuff that is coming up is already 20, 30 years old, and it's very satanic panicky. So it's not very useful other than just to kind of criticize in your intro. I think the easy one to choose would be 3, focusing on bodily autonomy, just because it aligns so well with sexual health and what I do. Promoting sex positivity. But I think more on a personal level, just 1, I think is best fitting, focusing on compassion and empathy within reason. And I think it's that within reason part that's very important and personal for me, because I would describe myself naturally as compassionate and empathic. That's more of my default setting. I need to work more on that reason piece of not being, a doormat or subjugating myself to everybody. So it's like this people pleaser. And so that one kind of resonates more on a personal level of what I need to be mindful of. And like I mentioned earlier, of waking up, not thinking of how can I fulfill tenet one better, but how can I be more authentic? And that authenticity is still having compassion and empathy, but putting some boundaries around it.
Now, one thing that will come up a few times in our conversation with Dr. Sprankle is the reference to being your most authentic self. In our conversation with him and the back and forth that we had, one thing that really resonated with me as, you know, the whole authentic self thing is one of my personal goals as I progress through my satanic journey, I guess you could call it. I can be a fucking dickhead sometimes, and that's okay. I mean, my co-host can attest to that. Shit gets heated sometimes. And,
we sure can.
And, but as can anybody. And we're allowed to be that, you know, and that's, and working through shit like that is part of becoming your most authentic self. And that's a never ending journey. You're going to hear that a lot in this presentation. Now, we owe it to ourselves, as far as I'm concerned, and the people that we love, to make an honest attempt every day to make steps to becoming that most authentic version. Throughout this presentation, we're also going to talk about some of the roadblocks that might come up in being our most authentic selves. So in regards to that whole thing, Dennis, Veronica, Al, do you all have any thoughts on maybe where you're at in your personal journey and kind of, you know, quickly on where, with this whole authentic self thing?
Speaking for myself, I definitely do. This transition that's coming up, pretty immediately is a perfect example, I feel, of me learning to become at least more authentic than I have been. My journey through Satanism so far, and I'm very new. This will be my first year as a Satanist and getting to know kind of all of the creed and all of the literature, but it's definitely shown me that a particular relationship of mine, I was in it to keep somebody happy, somebody who I, you know, really respected. There was a bond there, but it's also like making me reflect on, you know, things from my perspective. And that sounds weird, but yeah, you know, for the first time, or at least in a long time, certain things are from my perspective now. Like, what is authentic to me? What do I authentically feel is the best course of action for me? Maybe I don't have to spend the next year or the next month keeping this individual happy, because I'm in a situation where I'm not happy. So I can definitely relate to a lot of what Eric said.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Well, I can say, in terms of the biggest challenge for being truly authentic to yourself, is fear. It's fear of being, you know, rejected for who you are, for, you know, fear of, you know, being honest and forthright of your feelings and driving people away, or having someone reject you or leave you because of who you are and what you believe in and what you might say. So, and it's hard to get over that.
Yeah, definitely. And, we were talking about anger. You were saying about how you're an asshole sometimes, which, yeah, you are, but I'm definitely way worse than you. So don't worry about that. You can say asshole, jerk off, dickhead. I fall under all of them, the entire fucking book, dude. So you don't have to worry about that shit.
Just kidding there, Dennis. Just kidding.
But, you know, I'm just blunt and honest. People don't like it. They say I'm an asshole. Fuck you too, Belial. So, you know, they don't take to what I usually say kindly. And you know, I'm not trying to offend anybody, but if I offend them, you know, I'm sorry. I'm not going out of my way to do it. But at the same time, I try to work in the, you know, the first tenet at the same time, you know, like try to do everything within accordance to reason, you know, try and, you know, put my best foot forward, you know, but if shit needs to happen, shit needs to happen.
Yeah. And in regards to the whole dickhead thing, that's where, you know, I think the fourth tenet comes in, you know, try to rectify your mistake, you know, make amends, you know, dust yourself off and, you know, try to do right by your mistake and move forward. And that's all a part of the baby steps required to becoming more comfortable in our fucking skin every day that we walk this planet. Now, Dr. Sprankle made a few references to some of the studies he conducted in his introduction video and that we also mentioned in his introduction. His research project titled Satanism, Stigma, and Mental Health captured the attention of the entire satanic community and is featured as a two-part special on Satanic Temple TV. Now, if you just search Dr. Sprankle on TST TV, I believe his two-part series also offered for free as well. But in regards to his study, we're going to check in with Dr. Sprankle, and he's going to tell us a little more.
Yeah, so the origin of that study was actually supposed to be a little bit of a goof, not the topic itself, but me doing that research at Minnesota State. This was shortly after being called like a Satanist professor or someone that worships the devil because of some tweets I did that got some national attention on right-wing news outlets, and the university had to address it. And so I was being labeled all these different things, and so I was like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if I did a research study on Satanism or Satanists in which the university kind of had to acknowledge, so I have academic freedom, what I can do. I'm not going to get fired for doing this. And that they would have to kind of publicize that, oh, we have this faculty member doing Satanist research. So I just wanted to kind of double down on that label that I was being given by right-wing media. So it started off a little bit of a goof, maybe a little trolling. But what ended up happening was like this was becoming a very interesting project. We had great response from the satanic community of all types, TST definitely, but other affiliations as well participated. I think the first study that we did, we had like 1,800 people started it, and we were able to use about 1,300 responses. And for such a narrow type of community that we are sampling from, that's a huge number. So the response was great, and the results that we got were super interesting and can be very much applied to therapists and other clinicians who may have Satanists as their patients or their clients. And so what started out as a little bit of a goof, a little trolling on my own university, turned out to be a pretty legit research line in which right now, 5 out of 6 of my current grad students are involved in the research in some capacity, and 3 out of 6 have the data as some part of their thesis, their master's thesis. So Oh, wow. It's like, okay, I guess I'm a Satanist researcher now for the next couple of years. And so that's been great. The results, again, were fascinating. To briefly describe that, at least one part of it, what we found was that, well, the obvious thing was Satanists who anticipate that they're going to experience discrimination because of their Satanism, that correlated with higher rates of depression. That's true for other types of discrimination that we may experience based on other characteristics that we have. So I wasn't expecting that to be something unique, for Satanists. We saw that in other areas. What we saw too was that the greater ties that Satanists have with other Satanists, so feeling some camaraderie, some support from other Satanists, that also predicted that they were likely to experience discrimination, that they had more fear of experiencing discrimination, which kind of makes sense that they may be a little bit more out with their Satanism. And if they're out, they would be having some concerns with that being discriminated against. Kind of what's unique about this, though, is that also with more in-group ties, so the community that you feel with other Satanists was a protective factor against depression. So the higher your in-group ties were with other Satanists, the fewer depressive symptoms that you were reporting. So how we made sense out of this, and we did kind of a moderation analysis to look at all these variables, what happened was that the in-group ties, so the social support that Satanists got from other Satanists, actually serves as a protective factor from the depressive effects of anticipated discrimination. And why that's so important is because kind of going back to the lit review, that satanic panic literature from the 80s and 90s, and some of those case studies that were working with like teens who were dabbling in Satanism or whatever, They were viewing Satanism as a cause or a consequence to their mental health problems, and such treatment recommendations was to get these people out of Satanism, right, in order for their mental health to improve. Our data suggests otherwise, and the opposite, in fact, is that if you have a Satanist client or a patient who also has depressive symptoms, it's really important for the therapist or the clinician to explore what's their social support like with other Satanists. And if it's low, to work on ways to increase that social support with other Satanists. So actually to lean in more into your Satanism in order to help alleviate the depressive symptoms. Yeah, so we took a chunk of this data and wrote it up, and it's currently under review for publication in a peer-reviewed journal. So hopefully we'll get a green light from them and it gets published, and then they'll be like, okay, this is publishable material. And then we have a second study with the same data but looking at different variables, ready to go for a second submission. And then we can carve up this data in a lot of different ways to present interesting stuff. So we can get several papers out of it. So one's under review right now. We're going to see the feedback that we get from that before moving forward with more writing. Presentation-wise, I'm intentionally not presenting it right now to other clinicians because I want to wait for the pandemic to be over for conferences to go back to in-person as opposed to virtual, because I want to like release this information to present this for the first time in person to kind of gauge the room, really address concerns, biases that may be coming out of the attendees. So I really want to feel that like in person as opposed to do it virtually. So right. I'm intentionally holding off on doing that, but hopefully 2022, I'll be making the rounds through psych conferences and sexual health conferences, you know, sharing this data and seeing the kind of response that it gets from clinicians.
As far as the study goes, like we mentioned, it's a two-part series available on TST TV where he goes over a lot of the details of a study, his research findings, and how they can be applicable to further research and everything. I had a really good time talking to him about that. Anybody else?
I mean, in regards to what he was saying, just again, I'm going into a situation where like I'm not going to be around a bunch of Satanists. In fact, it's going to be the complete opposite situation. And I am going to have to be a little bit more aware of like what I say and how open I am about everything in regards of like the workplace. So what he's talking about with like stigma and the stigma that people may have on you because of your beliefs and because of the S word, the dreaded S word, and what effects that might have on you. You know, I hope that I'm not in a situation where I become more depressed because somebody finds out and somebody wants to hold that against me for any reason. Of course, like we as Satanists do our best to explain to people to our best ability, like, you know, it's not just the dreaded S word. But stigma is a big part of it. I'm seeing that a little bit more and more. And with this new situation I'm getting into, it's definitely, it might become an uphill battle. Hopefully not, but thank you, Eric, because it's stuff I needed to hear, you know, with that study. It's not stuff I needed to hear. It's stuff he objectively found out. So it's pretty cool.
Well, here's more stuff we need to hear, and that's updates and things that are going on with the Satanic Temple's religious reproductive rights campaign. Now, in a recent TST newsletter and update, and I'm quoting, it says that consistent with our tenets that call for bodily autonomy and acting in accordance with the best scientific evidence, TST religiously objects to many of the restrictions that states have enacted that interfere with abortion access. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act shields TST members from abortion regulations that call for procedures that do not promote patients' health and safety and force Satanists to violate their conscience and beliefs. The Satanic Temple has posted billboards in Miami, Houston, and Dallas that alert Satanists in these areas of the religious abortion ritual and their subsequent religious rights to receive reproductive care in accordance with their beliefs. Now, to piggyback off that, many of you may already be aware, but right now we've got a little bit of a billboard contest running. It started on February 1st and it goes through the 21st. TST says that they're inviting the entire community to participate in a billboard design contest. Now, this is in response to the difficulties getting announcements displayed. They purchased a 672 square foot billboard in Phoenix, Arizona. Members can submit their artwork for a chance of having it publicly displayed played on TST's very own Billboard. Like I said, they're accepting submissions all the way through February 21st. So get on that shit. Time is running out. And for the inaugural launch, design should address TST's religious reproductive rights campaign. And it says the Satanic Temple will choose 6 of the submitted designs and post them online in February, where members can vote for their favorite. Any design that makes it to the public voting round has the chance to be entered in TST's Billboard Wall of Fame, which will be found on their website. Now, votes will be in the form of tax-deductible donations to the Satanic Temple. Now, it's a double-edged sword here. Not only are you, you know, pushing and supporting someone's creativity in this campaign, you're also supporting the Satanic Temple at the same time. At the end of the voting period, the design that received the most donations will be displayed on TST's Phoenix, Arizona billboard for 3 months. And after that billboard duration lapses, the winner will receive their cloth billboard design by mail when it comes down. So just a real quick check-in. We are going to check in with Dr. Sprankle here.
I mean, it makes sense to me. I mean, I'm not a legal scholar by any means, but I think all of TST's campaigns to kind of point out the double standards that exist with this, you know, religious freedom is actually just Christian freedom. It just reinforces Christian supremacy. And anytime another religion, whether it's Satanism or Islam or any other religion, kind of wants an equal seat at the table, then, you know, we're all like, oh, wait, that's not actually what this means. And so I think, again, just like all of TST's campaigns that kind of do something similar, makes sense to me, and it's a pretty solid argument as to why this would fit into a religious exemption, as Christians are able to get religious exemptions, especially even within healthcare. But this requires, you know, obviously judges to see it the same way and not to have any type of anti-Satanist bias and to try to find some type of loophole as to why, no, this doesn't actually violate your constitutionally protected rights to religious freedom, and this is why. So, you know, it may make sense, but unfortunately, we are at the mercy of having some judges to ultimately determine whether or not they see it the same way, and they can easily be susceptible to anti-Satanism bias.
Now, TST just sent out an update on the religious rights campaign. A member should have received an email with an update on where things stand with the campaign and where we are headed. And I think Dr. Sprankle made a great point. No matter how solid the foundation of this campaign is, we unfortunately are at the mercy of legislation and judicial rulings. Now, I'm sure our entire community will be keeping a close eye on the progress of the campaign as it moves forward. And I kind of, when it comes to TST lawsuits and legislation and the legal battles, I kind of take the expect the worst and hope for the best approach, which I think a lot of people do. And that whole expect the worst, hope for the best approach is also a common theme in what a lot of our listeners have mentioned in our forums and threads on social media when it comes to expectations in the bedroom. Expect the worst, hope for the best. Now, it seems many of us... you know, it's weird. So it seems many of us, Satanists or not, go into sexual situations with unspoken pressure to perform, whether it's outlasting our partner when it comes to achieving orgasm or having the endurance of a Jehovah's Witness running down the street after knocking way too many times on my fucking door. We asked Dr. Sprankle about how to overcome unnecessary pressures and expectations and make it more of a playful, enjoyable experience for all. Now, when he's done answering for that, we will come right back to a video and a little special announcement that Satanic Study Hall kind of wants to make to the community, and we'll continue our conversation. So at this point, we are headed right in and talking about expectations beyond the bedroom.
Yeah, so I think it's very common for people to get like goal-oriented and goal-focused with sex. And I think that's just because we equate sex with having orgasms or sex with a particular type of sexual behavior, like penile vaginal intercourse. For some, sex means that and only that. And that requires our bodies to perform in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if a lot of factors can interfere with sexual functioning. And if that happens, then it's kind of like this all or nothing approach that we take to sex. If we can't do what we think sex is, have an orgasm through means X, Y, or Z, then I don't know what else we can do. And we're certainly not having sex. And unfortunately, how we typically define those X, Y, and Z avenues to sexual pleasure, they do require a certain amount of performance and function on the part of our bodies or just behaviorally. So we're kind of setting ourselves up to almost fail in a way. I mean, it works well for a lot of people. They go by without having any problems, but it's very easy for a comment, for a problem to arise. And then we're kind of stuck and not knowing what to do beyond kind of goal oriented performance based sex. Yeah. So when we do this therapeutically, so if a couple comes in saying that they're having problems with, you know, some type of sexual dysfunction or whatever, pretty much a gold standard in sex therapy is this process and this homework exercise that the couples do known as sensate focus. But anybody can do this, you don't have to be in sex therapy to partake. And so I'll give you like the very stripped down version. Essentially, you know, try to figure out with your partner, how can you experience sexual pleasure and sexual satisfaction without your genitals being involved at all? And so that's the kind of the basis of this. It's a counter conditioning process. And that if we take our genitals out of the equation, that completely removes any performance demands, any goal oriented demands that we have on ourselves. And then we're free to explore how our body's going to respond to different types of stimulation from head to toe, just without the genitals involved. And we can think of this too. And this is a funny question I ask couples when I used to do clinical work that would come in, say that they haven't had sex in like a year or more. What can we do? And I really kind of work with them defining like, what do you mean by sex? And I ask sometimes like, well, when was the last time the two of you, and this may be a couple in their 40s, 50s, or 60s, been together for several decades. When was the last time the two of you just had like a 10-minute like hardcore makeout session? Didn't do anything else other than that. Just like really made out on the couch for like 10 minutes or more. And they really laugh at that because they haven't done that. They haven't done that since they first started dating. But once they kind of graduated to like what they consider real sex, then all those other behaviors that were certainly pleasurable and satisfying and felt good to engage in, they just become stepping stones to something else and ultimately get avoided if we don't want to do that something else. Because those early behaviors now don't exist by themselves independent. They are just precursors to something else. And that something else may be off the table now because of sexual dysfunction, or you just may not want to engage in that behavior or something like that. So if we're able to take the genitals out of it, just say like for a week, 2 weeks, whatever you want, really kind of explore how can you connect with your partner? How can you have fun? How can you experience bodily and sexual pleasure even when your genitals are involved? And that just by itself will take a lot of the pressure away because your body's not expected to behave in any particular way. You're not waiting for arousal. You're not waiting for a timing of an orgasm. You're just there to have fun and to feel good.
I wonder if that works on we single people. I don't know. I was trying to figure that one out.
It can too. I mean, like therapeutically, when we have just individuals who are single but are experiencing sexual dysfunction, you just do the same thing with masturbation. Take the focus initially off of the genitals, explore your body head to toe, what feels good, what doesn't. And then you can slowly incorporate the genitals if the focus is more on kind of correcting a dysfunction. But yeah, it is still self-stimulation. Find out on yourself what feels good, what doesn't.
So in regards, kind of going backwards to what Dr. Sprinkle was saying, you know, I never really thought about it like that in regards to the whole making out thing like he was talking about. I mean, me, when I thought about that, that's kind of fucking true. Like when you become comfortable or finally conquer the whole sex thing with your partner, you know, I've been in a long relationship, but I don't think I've ever really made out with a partner like Dr. Sprinkle said, you know, after the initial courting or getting to know you phase outside of being shit-based drunk. What about the rest of you?
I mean, I've definitely made out with partners, you know, after the initial, I guess, sexual encounter, and just have done that. But it definitely like opened my mind up to like what's going to happen when I get older, because I'm still very young. So it's like if you do settle down with your primary partner, I guess, in this case, and you kind of like you reach a point in your relationship where you have to be reintroduced to each other, maybe just like emotionally and sexually. It's not something I think a lot about right now. I'm going to be honest. I'm kind of like independent on my own. I kind of like see who I want, and it's all really fun. And there's no serious commitments right now. So he did make me think a lot about that and the way people's maybe sexual relationships change over time. So that's what I got out of it.
And very similar to Dr. Sprinkle's comments around dependency on the judicial system to achieve our goals as a community, many of the roadblocks and issues we face depend on that very same thing to initiate real change. Coming up, we asked Dr. Sprinkle if there's anything to be celebrated in regards to sexual health and liberation as of late, and to outline opportunities that he sees in regards to the work that still needs to be done. Let's check it out.
Tend to be a little bit of a pessimist of finding good things that we can celebrate. One thing that comes to mind, and I wish I would have looked this up in more detail because I just read it yesterday or the day before. I saw that there is a new HIV medication that can be administered with a monthly dose. So if somebody has HIV now, they're dependent on kind of a daily cocktail of different meds. Works great and can suppress viral loads down to undetectable levels. And if you're undetectable, you can't transmit it. So we're definitely in a different place with HIV now than we were, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, when it was definitely looked at as just a death sentence. But now it can definitely be managed with the right treatment and early interventions. And daily pills, though, can be very challenging. And so this FDA-approved medicine that can just be once-a-month injections can free up a lot of people's time and energy, and those who are just forgetful to take a daily pill. So it can still suppress viral loads down to undetectable levels, just maybe in a better-suited administrative route via injection than daily pills. So that's certainly something to celebrate, another option for HIV treatment. For where we still have to go, pretty much everything else. That's my pessimism. The work is never ending. There's always something that needs to be challenged, to be worked on. I'm hoping with a little bit of a breath air, at least in the United States, with the turn of administrations, that we don't have to keep putting out fires every day, that we can focus on some of these initiatives a little bit more full steam ahead than just kind of playing defense. But that's through everything with like sex work criminalization, LGBT rights, K-12 sex education, access to contraception and abortion. All these things have so much work to do or to go to actually get to the sexually liberated part. But I'm at least somewhat hopeful with the changing of the tide this month in the United States that maybe we can make a little bit more gains than we have in the past 4 years.
We will take any small wins that we can get as a community, especially with the HIV monthly medication that Dr. Sprenkel mentioned. You know, overall, we still have a long fucking way to go to achieve true sexual liberation. Now, in our next video on the same topic, Dr. Sprenkel tells us what he thinks he views as the biggest roadblock overall outside of legislation. And I must say, his answer probably won't surprise you.
Probably not.
Yeah, it's the church, right? Broadly speaking, right? In the United States, it's Christianity, mm-hmm. all its branches. You can get into like larger issues of like, you know, it's our economic system and the church is just like a part of that and they feed into each other. Yeah. But like what you feel the most, and I think what's most in our faces is the impact of Christianity and Christian nationalism and Christian supremacy in the United States and elsewhere, and both directly, how we're influenced by that, but also indirectly. I think this also impacts atheists and other non-believers. They have, you know, some sex negativity, and it's because of the cultural messages that we receive around sex. And where do those cultural messages come from, or at least get reinforced as this is truth? It's coming from the church. And so chipping away, and that's why I'm not opposed to Christianity per se. Like, I'm actually fascinated by different belief systems, and I view it all through the lens of like mythology, and I'm interested in what people believe and how they make sense out of the world and different customs and traditions that they have. That's all fascinating for me from like an anthropological perspective. What I'm opposed to is the power that Christianity has on a socio-political level, the Christian nationalism that is desired in this country by so many people. That's what I want to attack. That's what I want to chisel away from, because I think if we chisel away from that, then we'll experience greater levels of sex positivity and sexual liberation, because that's what's kind of holding our reins right now.
So, I mean, fuck religious nationalism and fuck the righteous. Fuck the righteous.
And fuck them up, you know, their ass.
With all this talk about getting fucked, take a sip out of my mug here. Fuck Pearl Jam, too.
Fuck Pearl Jam.
That's right. What do you think about that, Belial? Oh, look, he said fuck Pearl Jam, too. Moving on the next topic we talk about is the topic of sexual education in the school system. On a podcast that Dr. Sprenkel previously appeared on, which was the Atheist Community of Folk County podcast, he spoke of the difficulties of sexual education being controlled at the state level here in the U.S., as opposed to being controlled on a federal level or with more federal oversight. He used an analogy like the COVID response, which I absolutely love, which basically said that we have 50 different states and 50 different approaches, or in some cases, multiple cases of negligence when it comes to sex education in our whole entire education system. We asked Dr. Sprenkel what he thinks a successful federal education program or a program with more federal oversight would look like.
Yeah, in terms of rolling that out, I have no idea. I'd want, obviously, input from the educators who are doing that work. I only see what happens with the lack of K-12 comprehensive sex ed once they get to college and they're taking my kind of intro to psychology of sexual health, a 200-level class where I'm their first sex educator in their life. It's like, okay, we have to cover some basic stuff before we kind of even get to like a low-level college-level class. And so it would be nice that, you know, they were better prepared through their K-12 education that we can actually get to more advanced topics, even in a lower-level college class. So I would default to what the educators in the K-12 system actually think that would look like rolling out. But there are a lot of groups and organizations like CECUS is one, Advocates for Youth. They're all doing a great job pushing for better comprehensive, medically accurate, inclusive sexuality education, K-12. And right now they are just, it's a piecemeal approach. You know, there's no federal oversight for sex ed. A lot of times it is funded differently depending on the current administration, whether there's only funds available for abstinence only education versus funding for more comprehensive type of sex ed. But ultimately curriculum is decided at the state Department of Ed level, and then a lot of times at the district level, of which like textbooks or curricula a particular district is assigned. So that's just my personal I don't know if ideology or political beliefs that I would like to have this more centralized and at the federal level, so it's more standard of what. So even if you're a rural kid in Alabama, you're getting the same type of comprehensive, medically accurate sex ed as a kid growing up in a posh district in like the Upper East Side of Manhattan, that there wouldn't be differences in the type of sex education that you have access to, at least formally in your schooling. How that would actually look like in a rollout, I would have to defer to the K-12 educators who would actually be doing that work. Yeah, I'm very intentional with that language, like that K-12. Mm-hmm. And I know that's a button issue. If I want to really drive the right wing and reactionaries, like just make them irate, use K-12. Because to them, they think kindergartners are learning about the best lube to use for anal sex or something. In their mind, they can't think of sexuality that is age appropriate. For them, they're just projecting what sex means for them and putting on all age groups. And like you were saying, it has to be age appropriate. There are things that exist for a kindergartner that is relevant to their lives. Just understanding what their bodies are, you can start teaching them the very basics of consent in the forms of just who gives them a hug, who gives them a kiss, who can sit next to them. These are consent education things that then later on in their life have applied value in sexual relationships. So not only do they have a better understanding of like bodily autonomy at a young age of like what's appropriate touch and who can touch me and when I can say no, and that's respected. And if people are telling me to keep secrets, that's not good, right? And who to talk to if this kind of stuff is happening, but also having the language to talk about what's happening. And for the parents or the teachers, whoever the caregivers are listening to this, that they are receptive to that, that they have the comfort level to deal with these topics. Because I think of that Penn State case, right? All the sexual abuse that happened in Penn State a couple of years ago. I forget the guy's name, Jerry Sandusky, I think was the...
It was a whole mess.
Mess, covered up. A lot of people knew about it, including the head coach, Paterno, right? And my belief, I'm kind of... maybe filling in some gaps here that I don't know about the story, but he was largely, you know, not sharing that information once he kind of learned about it. And my belief with that is that this guy was a pretty devout Catholic, that this issue was just so uncomfortable for him. He could not talk about it to other people. He did not have the language to talk that he knew children were being abused under his watch at the hands of somebody that he knows, nor would he even have the language to start explaining that to other people. So the more comfortable we are about sexuality, ours, others, yes, I think that would definitely have a direct impact on at least how we deal with sexual assault.
All right. So one, we were reading the chat while Dr. Sprinkle was speaking, and we don't eat our puppies with Pearl Jam.
I do.
I use Nutella. Anyways, flavor. Anyways, so in regards to what Dr. Sprankle just spoke to, a more structured and efficient sexual education system will surely set up our children and future generations to make better decisions as they progress through their life experiences. Now, I can't help but think that if something like this had been in play when I was growing up, my generation wouldn't be having such a difficult time navigating through all this sexual liberation and positivity or learning how to set boundaries, etc.
This is where I slightly, it's not disagreeing outright with the doctor, but it's also, it's suspending belief until I see it. Just, you know, with experiences thus far with the two parties that currently, you know, have a kind of monopoly on the system. I don't find that the federal anything controls anything better than private or state entities, or at least it's not true in a lot of the cases. So I would have to see like a federal program of sexual education really kind of like come through with results until I believe that fully. But to Eric's credit, I totally agree with the idea of teaching kids about these kind of boundaries as early as possible, so that if they are in a home environment where someone has complete control over them, like a relative or a parent that they can't necessarily speak out about, I think that would do a lot of good for teachers and neighbors and any kind of like authority adult figure in their lives to start teaching them about like the right and not okay, or even, you know, middle ground between who is approaching them appropriately. So I did get a lot out of this portion.
No, well said. And, you know, I think the whole education experience, and he said K through 12, as he mentioned numerous times, is that sets you up for, you know, to have the acumen to tackle adulthood with the right skill set and tools and, you know, mental capacity and just things and experiences. But, you know, stuff like that also preps you for, like I said, difficult, you know, times and things that we immerse ourselves in as we get older, whether it's polyamory or non-monogamous relationships, or just, you know, trying different things. Now, on the topic of polyamory and non-monogamous relationships, I know I have, and many of the panel here, and not just Satanists, but, you know, we've talked to a lot of people that are in that polyamorous or non-monogamous lifestyle who have shared both positive experiences, but also many struggles that arise when navigating this liberating yet complicated journey. We asked Dr. Sprankle what advice he would have for anyone who is either considering this lifestyle or who is active in the lifestyle or, you know, just recently entered into it. So with more on that, let's check in with Eric.
Yeah. So I'd say take it slow. Understand that polyamory, open relationships, non-monogamy, whatever you want to call it. And there are differences between those. Some are umbrella terms, some aren't. But if you are opening up your relationship, if you are used to monogamy, whether this is a new relationship or one that's already been established monogamously for some time and you're thinking about a different structure, just really understand what your motivations are for opening it up. And are you just looking as opening up as a reason to kind of have one foot out the door? So you see that therapeutically a lot of couples come in wanting that they have some dissatisfaction in their relationship and they want to open it up thinking that that will make the primary relationship stronger, where in fact what's happening is that that's just kind of one foot out the door. They're not ready to say I'm done with this, I want to go on. It's kind of testing the waters, and once they realize that other people may be meeting their needs a little bit better, then they're able to kind of take that next step. So really understand like what your motivation is. And are you trying to do this to enhance the primary relationship? And if so, how do you think that actually is going to happen? And also understand, I think a big myth, this may be more common in the swinging community of actually living up to this myth, but I think less so in the polyamory community, that it's like way, way, way more talking than it is actually having any kind of sexual behavior. It was like 100 to 1, right? If you're doing it cautiously, checking in with people, what are their boundaries? How are your insecurities doing? Addressing jealousies that come up, which are inevitable. It's not unhealthy to experience jealousy. It's how you talk about it and navigate it once it does. And just know that it's not going to be like a nonstop orgy once you and your partner decide to open up the relationship. If that's the case, a lot of times it will kind of fall apart quickly because you're not talking about what you're comfortable with, what you're not comfortable with, kind of slowing the pace down, putting some boundaries around things. Because when you look at open relationships, let's say you're just opening it up to one other person or maybe two other people, like, you know, each partner is exploring a new relationship with somebody else, just one other person. Every monogamous relationship has their own boundaries. even within monogamy, some are more comfortable with, you know, friendships with exes or hanging out with certain, you know, genders, going to strip clubs, watching porn. That's all, those are all various boundaries that monogamous people have. And there's no right or wrong. It's just making sure you're on the same page. When you're adding an additional person to people, all you're doing is really moving the boundary a little bit further, right? Now you're just considering another person's boundaries and making sure that they align with yours. But it's not really opening it up the floodgates where anything goes. That's usually kind of the general recommendation of like, just don't open the floodgates because it's going to get messy and traumatic very quickly. Make sure you're taking step by step, recognizing that a polyamorous relationship is really no different than a monogamous relationship. It just requires a lot more talking, a lot more boundary talks, checking in, negotiations, things like that.
All right, everybody, welcome back. You know, on that note, when I was in the swinging community or part of the lifestyle, I had no fucking idea and didn't realize how much talking, conversation, and checking in was part of making all parties as comfortable as possible, being communicative, respectful, boundary conversation. And he is absolutely right. From my personal experience, a lot more time is spent talking and managing the situation outside of actual sex. Now, that was years back. I definitely learned a lot about myself, and I'd have to say that the whole swinging experience in you know, my mid-20s into my early 30s kind of started my, you know, journey into really understanding and supporting my own and others' sex positivity and liberation.
This is a first year for a lot of things with me, but this is definitely you know, a year where I've had more than one partner, and kind of like managing that as somebody who's definitely not as sexually active maybe as other people, and definitely doesn't come from a background of polyamorous relationships. It's always really good to get advice from people who are a little bit more advanced in the community and have a better idea of like what works healthily within it and what doesn't.
Absolutely. Now, it's obviously never wise to completely immerse yourself into a new environment or community without first fully understanding it and recognizing potential uncomfortabilities, just doing your research. We asked Dr. Sprankle about safe, slow, and healthy ways for less sexually active Satanists to branch out and how people with negative sexual history and experiences can work towards transforming sex into a celebration. After his answer, I think we have an appearance from Kenny Powers. We'll see what's up with that. But let's check in with the doc.
Yeah, so two things. One, I would want to make sure that you're not putting undue pressure on yourself to live up to some expectation that you think a fully liberated Satanist sexual person is supposed to be, because there isn't any, all right? Sexuality within Satanism doesn't have to look any different than sexuality within any other religion. It's just finding out what's right for you and living accordingly. So that's number one, to not put pressure on yourself to fulfill some outside expectation as to what you think a Satanist should or should not be doing sexually. Find out what's right for you. That's Satanism. So the second part of that, if you are looking to branch out and that's part of your authentic self, there's a lot of different avenues to explore. I mean, if the barriers are significant enough, I always have to throw in the qualifier of, you know, you may need to work through some of these barriers, process some of these barriers, these challenges with some type of mental health provider. But on a self-help level, just exposing yourself to comprehensive, medically accurate, inclusive sexuality education as the counterbalance to all the bullshit that we've been fed our entire lives that is not medically accurate, that's not comprehensive and not inclusive. That alone, just increasing our sexual intelligence, our knowledge about all different aspects of sexuality, can start opening ourselves up to just understanding sexuality and its diversity, but also being more comfortable exploring those different avenues.
Now, remembering that there are no set standards or expectations and that there isn't a specific mold for sex positivity and liberation within this community or any other community is pretty much the key thing that I pulled out of that. Overall, educate yourselves, whether it's sex positivity, sexual liberation, Satanism. If you're passionate about it, learn about it. Know what you're getting into. Never stop learning. And hail fucking Satan.
Know a good way to engage in rather specific vanities?
What's that?
Prostitutes. Let's check in with a good doctor about sex work misconceptions and the path to normalizing and accepting sex work.
I like prostitutes.
Let's do it.
Prostitutes like all of us.
Yeah, pretty much everything. I mean, sex work stigma is well documented anecdotally, case reports, large quantitative studies. It's there. There's no denying it, that it's not there. And there's a lot of different theories as to how this came about. But I think a simple way to kind of think of it is what, at least in our culture, and I'll be like American centric here for a second, which is, I guess, common for Americans to do, but just kind of think of U.S. culture. What is normative sexual behavior, normative sexual relationships, or at least what is permissible in our culture? And obviously religion influences that a lot. And the more we deviate from that norm or what is permissible, the more stigma that is attached to it. And sex workers exist way outside of that normative. So not only they're engaging in sex outside of marriage and just for pleasure, it's transactional. It's casual. For a lot of times it's casual. But the transactional nature of it falls way outside of what is considered permissible sexual behavior in our culture. And again, the more outside of that we get, the more stigma is attached to it. And in this case, even the more criminalization that's attached to it. Well, what sex workers say, they want decriminalization. So it's criminalized in most areas of the United States. A couple of counties in Nevada are the exception where it's legalized, not decriminalized. So decriminalization is the goal. There's problems with legalization that I won't go into. But sex workers and research support where it is decriminalized, like in New Zealand, that creates safer working conditions, because we need to think of like sex work as work and sex workers as workers. And if workers are working within criminalized conditions, that's going to breed unhealthy, unsafe conditions for them to work in. If they're working in stigmatized conditions, that still can create unhealthy and unsafe working conditions, but at least the criminalized component is removed from it. So that's the first step, is to decriminalize sex work to make it safer.
We were singing. We didn't think the video was going to end that soon.
Mistakes were made.
You know, that was a pretty serious topic. We did not want to come in with laughs, but, you know, I think we can all agree here that decriminalization of the sex work industry opens up new doors to progressive safety and even new expansions of market, which economically benefit all parties.
Definitely.
Dismantling harsh judgments of those who work in the industry would definitely create healthier environments. The demand for dismantling judgment also relates to those who do not engage in sexual activity at all, or those who may not have as much interest as sexually active people. Now, moving forward, we asked Dr. Sprinkle a really important question to some of our listeners. Now, many of us come from backgrounds, trauma, abuse, psychological manipulation, religious oppression, a large scope of medical conditions that also may make, you know, we already did this one. Never mind. We're going to move forward. Yes. Yeah. See, we saved a few minutes on the agenda. Yeah. Call in an audible. So what we're going to go to now, and I merged my notes here. I spent way too much time prepping for this. So what we're going to do is really kind of talk about, what are we going to talk about? See, I'm all fucked up right now. Let's talk about, let's talk about predatory and behavior and respect. I think it's pretty important to address serious topics in these avenues. We like to fool around and talk, but one of the most passionate responses we got from Dr. Sprinkle and other people we've asked this question to is around, you know, just making good decisions and how to respond to sometimes predatory behavior in sexual liberated communities. So that's kind of the direction that we're going here. Dr. Sprinkle had a really good answer. So we're going to go check it out.
Yeah, so this is a great question and can be applied well beyond the Satanist community. I've come across this in other sex positive circles, sex education, sex research, sex therapy, going to conferences, professional conferences in these areas. And this is an issue. So I think it's this false belief that sex positive people, sexually liberated people, are open for anything and they're game for anything. It's like a blanket consent that, yes, whatever you want to throw my way, I'll be receptive to it. And I think that's a very big misunderstanding and a myth about what sex positivity and sexual liberation is. Liberation and positivity are about attitudes and about perception. It has nothing to do about behavior. right? Sexual liberation on a like a sociocultural level or even legal level, political level, just allows us to express ourselves sexually that is authentic to us without coming across sociocultural barriers, unnecessary arbitrary barriers, right? So that's liberation, getting rid of those barriers. It doesn't mean you have to go through all the barriers if that's not authentic for you. Nor should be people coming in your direction just because they're sexually liberated. And same thing with sex positivity. Sex positivity doesn't mean you have to do every kind of sexual behavior imaginable in order to prove yourself to be sexually positive. Sex positivity is recognizing what your own sexual values are and living according to those values so they're congruent, and understanding that other people are going to be different and they're going to have their own values and engage in behaviors that are congruent with that. That's all sex positivity is. And so I think it's conflating sex positivity, sexual liberation with sexual consent and like this blanket consent that really gets people into trouble with crossing boundaries, being inappropriate, just thinking that they're okay with even like sexual jokes, right? Or innuendos, just because you're the sex guy, right? You're the sexually liberated person. You should be okay with that. That has nothing to do, your comfort level has nothing to do with sex positivity or sexual liberation. And so boundaries still need to be communicated and not assumed by others. And so asked what other people's boundaries are before progressing to even like a sexual joke or pursuing some type of sexual romantic relationship with somebody, not making assumptions. Everybody has their own boundaries and it can all exist within the umbrella of sex positivity.
So I think the bottom line here is sexually liberated communities and sexually positive communities do not equal blanket consent or open doors for excessive or unwanted pressures. Straight into the point, you know, show respect, respect yourself, respect each other, have fucking fun, you know, magic word and everything that we're discussing here when it comes to, you know, sexual exploration, positivity, liberation is consent. And kind of what we talked back further is, you know, making that honest attempt to be your most authentic self. Now
respect new people in the community too. If you are a more experienced member, you know, explain things, be a guide. Don't be somebody who takes advantage of somebody else. And I think that's just the bottom line.
Yeah, there's really not much more to say about that is, you know, and take care of each other, you know, look out for each other, look out for the newbies into the community that might be not making, you know, such decisions that might be, you know, so well thought out. Now moving forward, it's time to ask Dr. Sprankles a few questions. I know it's getting late, we're getting close to time, but we're going to keep going. So it's time to ask Dr. Sprankles some questions that were farmed out of our goat farm. The very first question that comes up is around how to bring sex back into a damaged relationship or marriage. Doesn't have to be a marriage, but we all go through different things where sex kind of lacks and we get used to it and we might not address it. So let's get Dr. Sprankle's thoughts on that.
Yeah, I don't think anything's unique to Satanism. Satanism certainly is much more permissible. It is just kind of finding out what's right for you. It is definitely takes more of a secular humanist approach. You know, there's no, as long as there's consent involved, there's no right or wrong on kind of like a morality level that other religions try to prescribe, that it's only okay within these boundaries, right? Satanism widens those boundaries quite considerably. But in terms of that process, no, there's nothing pretty unique about that Satanists would have to be mindful of. It would just be having that conversation with your partner, whether or not you know, you're in a rut or looking just to explore different things with your partner. It all really just boils down to open, honest conversations with your partner. And a lot of times just having to acknowledge the impasse that you may be in, right? That unspoken impasse that is often the case, that you've been having problems for a long time, not really directly addressing it, at least head on, of just starting with acknowledging like, hey, this is how I've been feeling. Even if it's like, this is how I've been feeling the past 5 years and haven't really articulated it very directly or assertively, just starting there. And that serving as a starting point for many, many conversations to come about what you want sexually, what your needs are, what your partner needs are. And if there are differences, which there will be differences in sexual needs, there will be incompatibilities, there will be desire discrepancies. How can you navigate that together while still maintaining the integrity of the relationship if that's the goal?
Once again, straight and to the point. It's basically root cause analysis and being able to have that conversation with your partner where there is active listening and not just waiting for your turn to speak. People in relationships go years without addressing root causes of their problems. The only way to get your needs met is to confront them directly together. Our next question comes from our Discord family and is around sexual addiction. What exactly is sexual addiction, and what are some of the potential consequences of certain sexual addictions?
Yeah, so I'll back out a moment, because that's a very loaded term, sex addiction. How it's typically used is incorrect and just doesn't line up with the data that exists on this type of phenomenon. So I, regardless of what we call it, like where I like to start, so I'm not like people who think sex addiction is 100% real and I'm a sex addict or this person's a sex addict, I dated one, not to get kind of bogged down on the semantics, so to speak, and like then people start really going to start dismissing what I'm going to say after this. I think we can all agree that sexual behavior can become problematic for some individuals, right? The clinical issue at that point then is what's causing this problem? How do we assess it? How do we diagnose it in terms of like, what do we call it? And then what do we do about it in terms of like treatment? And this is important in terms of the label because sex addiction kind of falls under, well, it's an addiction. And are we going to treat it then like another addiction in which abstinence is the goal? Like if we take a 12-step approach, which a lot of like sex addiction kind of programs do, abstinence from a lot of different types of sexual behavior is ultimately the goal. As opposed to recognizing that, okay, maybe it's less about the sexual behavior per se, and maybe that person's relationship with that behavior or the context in which that behavior is being expressed. That's actually the problem. So let's change the context. Let's change the relationship in which this is being expressed, and then that alleviates the problem. So that's the little qualifier that I add to any talk about quote-unquote sex addiction. But where you see this being a problem primarily is just relationally. When I was doing clinical work, a big chunk of my work was dealing with individuals who had some type of what we called at the time like compulsive sexual behavior. And that would kind of be synonymous with how people use sex addiction right now. And so where this was most damaging was relationally. And what was most damaging was actually the secrets that were being kept and the betrayal that happened once that secret was discovered. It was very rarely disclosed by the person engaging in the behavior. It was discovered by their partner. And their partner realized that their spouse was having this secret sex life. And it was usually online. It rarely involved other people in real life. It was usually like porn or chat rooms, webcams, that kind of stuff. In a compulsive nature. And it was compulsive because it was shrouded in secrecy. They would have to wait for their family to go to bed. And then they would be online for a couple of hours on, you know, porn sites, masturbating, whatever. And then one day, their browser history gets discovered by their partner. It's like, oh, this is what you're doing when you don't come to bed right away. And then that impact on the relationship. So it's less about like the porn. It's less about the masturbation, even though that may be the focus in their mind in that moment of what's so upsetting. The root of it, what is upsetting, what is damaging, is the secret keeping and the betrayal that results from that. And so then the work moving forward is repairing that damage from the betrayal, the lack of trust, how to rebuild that. And then ultimately how to rebuild their sexual behavior, their sexual needs. Clearly they were trying to get a sexual need met in secret. How can they get that need met in a non-secretive way? Right? Whether that's with their partner or not, it can still be by themselves, but it's just private now instead of secret.
Right.
That's the big difference. That's not going to be damaging. Privacy is not damaging to relationships. Secrecy is.
I have a question. I think some of the people here might be sexually inexperienced. Is it true that if you don't use it, you lose it?
What in the fuck?
You know, I used to think that if you didn't use it, you'd lose it. And when I was a teenager, man, I ain't gonna lie, I thought I was addicted to jerking off right off the bat. Like I did have to go to the doctor to get checked out for doing it too much. But that might be TMI. So I'm gonna sip my cup here.
Just as a child, though?
Yeah, I know.
I'm still a teenager.
I'm still at that fucking level.
Here we are talking about jerking off.
I know it was cool to go off script, but you know, sometimes I think you guys need a therapist.
Well, Veronica, as Satanist, what should we look for in a therapist?
I don't know. Let's ask Sprankle.
Let's ask Sprankle.
All right, Sprankle.
Yeah, so this is where kind of the second part of my research is, looking at therapist characteristics that Satanists value or would want, and their likelihood of disclosing that they're a Satanist to their therapist, and what kind of predicts that, that disclosure or concealment. And this is where I really hope to take the research into an applied setting and train therapists to be better at serving the needs of Satanist clients or patients. So right now, based on kind of preliminary looks at some of the data, what was very important for the bulk of our participants was cultural humility. And what that means is that a therapist does not make an assumption about the cultural identities and culture that their patient is in or represents. So in this case, it would be a therapist that's not making automatic assumptions about what a Satanist is. And so that kind of really gets into challenging, like, does this therapist buy into like recovered memories and secret satanic cults that are abusing people all over the world? Or are they just going to hear that I'm a Satanist and be inquisitive about that without judgment? Ask me what that means and not try to do anything more than that, than just kind of learn about it based on what their patient is saying. That's cultural humility. That's favored by therapists or by clients of therapy. And so for someone looking for a therapist, it's not expected that they have a lot of degree of understanding of what Satanism is, has a lot of experience working with other Satanists. There's not unique tools to be used with Satanists. So really it's just vetting on the process of, are they essentially culturally humble in the sense that they won't make kind of biased judgments about me before kind of getting to know my story and let me tell them what Satanism means to me and how it impacts and is integrated into my life. That can be vetted through early communication with a therapist of simply asking, have you ever worked with a Satanist client before, or like an atheist? What would you think? How would you feel working with a Satanist client? Some of those questions you can start based on their answers, see if they do have cultural humility or not.
Thank you, Dr. Sprinkel. And we are at the finish line here in our conversation. Next, we wrap things up by asking a question that is not only relevant to the Lupercalia holiday, but something I think in some way we can all relate to and pull something out of. The ancient Roman festival of Lupercalia was observed to avert evil spirits and purify the city, releasing health and fertility through the sacrifices and goat hide thwackings we referred to earlier.
Not the puppies.
The Satanic Temple's holiday of the same name translates this holiday into a Hail Yourself Day. And as such, and I know this is a broad question, but we asked Dr. Sprinkel what guidance he has for anyone struggling with their gender identity and life choices.
Yeah, so I think it is first important to know that the struggle is being caused by society, nothing internal. There's nothing that you're doing that is creating this distress, right? There's nothing distressing that's inherent to gender identity, to sexual orientation, to sexual preferences, kinks, fetishes, sexual relationships, anything like that. It's how they're treated by society. And then that clash, if they're treated poorly by society, but that's who we are, that's what we're into, or that's what we're interested in, or that's what we are doing, then that creates the discomfort, that creates the distress, and what comes with that, a lot of negative health outcomes as a result. So it's important to know that that discomfort, that struggle is externally placed upon you, unfortunately and unfairly. So know that, number one, so don't beat yourself up that you're feeling this way. This is kind of society's kind of molding us to feel this way. And in terms of that, hail thyself, to feel authentic, you know, that can be a journey, a therapeutic journey, that can be, you know, 10, 20 years in the making for someone to fully manifest their true self. And that task can certainly be overwhelming. So just shrink it down to like on the daily level, maybe even in correspondence to this one particular holiday, asking yourself, what can you do today to be a little bit more authentic to your true sense of self, sexually speaking, gender, whatever the case may be. But just kind of moving that like slight bit, like an inch, right? Whereas true authenticity may be a mile, right? What can you do that's just moving you an inch? And that's a success in and of itself.
Well, Dr. Sprinkel, thank you so much. I think we have hit you with enough. This is we've gone for about an hour and a half here. This has been fantastic. And again, just I hope you enjoy your Lupercalia holiday, and we definitely would love to have you back in Study Hall to talk about some other hot topic stuff that might fall under the umbrella of your expertise. So thank you very much. Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Father Al. Thank you to our listeners and everybody on the Goat Farm who submitted these some of these awesome questions. And, you know, we look forward to talking to you again. Hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
All right. We had an awesome fucking time talking to Dr. Sprinkle, and we can't thank him enough for spending time with us in Study Hall. It was a real privilege to have him and get his thoughts on everything that we, you know, put in his plate in regards to all these questions we threw at him. So thank you so much, Dr. Sprinkle. That was fucking amazing. And thank you all for being here. We are in the home stretch. If you want to find, I believe, more information on Dr. Sprinkle, you can go right to drsprinkle.com. And don't forget to check out his TST videos about Satanism, stigmas, and mental health. Also, don't forget to submit your quizzes before 1 a.m. Oh, I say before 1 a.m. There's no fucking deadline. Fuck you, Principal Pan. Get them in. Submit them tomorrow. We want to see some entries. We got a couple already. Kind of funny. But we thank you for participating. It was kind of cool to try this and get your entry, you know, entered in for that giveaway. Again, you're going to get a free month of Patreon, some cool art, and a Satanic Study Hall t-shirt. Now, what's coming up with Satanic Study Hall? Our friend Dennis over there is putting together a global park cleanup that will be rolling out sooner than later. Excited about that, aren't you, Dennis?
I am extremely excited about that. We are going to be calling it Bag Me to Hell. And yeah, we're hopefully doing as much of the globe as possible in one day. I know we've got a couple people in Scotland, England, and Germany already participating in it and trying to spread the news as well. So yeah, if anybody wants to pitch in, just go out, find a park, find a spot in your city. We're just trying to make it a little cleaner for us.
Yeah, and definitely keep an eye on our social media for more information. Goat Farm Group Therapy, we do video Zoom chats on the first Wednesday of every month. So definitely stop by and say hi. Most of us show up, except for fucking Johnny. And speaking of which, it is Johnny's birthday. So yes, hail Johnny. Hail Happy Johnny. Well, Voorhees. It was Johnny's birthday, but it's still fucking Johnny's birthday. So yes, hail Johnny Voorhees. Hail our life coach. Happy fucking birthday, brother.
I got him a present.
Where'd you get him?
What'd I get him? Johnny, this is for you, buddy.
Oh, Baby Ruth. Baby Ruth for Satanic Study Hall's very own sloth. So yes, we have a Discord server, we have an art room, we do tenant talk Tuesdays, episodes that are coming up. We've got the AV cart, more movie reviews, music appreciation day, where we just sit back, do nothing, listen to music and talk shit, a musical journey that Johnny just recorded, which is fantastic, and of course our Satanic Study Hall Varsity Collection. So quick special thanks, obviously, Dr. Sprinkle, everybody here at TSTVHQ, all the audible you had to call getting ready for Lupercalia, all the prep work that goes involved in this. It is fucking phenomenal. Thank you for having us. We have a blast every time that we associate with this awesome group of people that run this. Love City Satanists out of Philadelphia. Hail fucking Satan, y'all. We love everything that you're doing and keep it up. Our VIP patrons, it's a lot of people that pay good money to listen to us and support what we're doing here. And that's humbling as shit. So thank you all for what you do to support us. You keep us going. You keep us focused and motivated. All of our listeners around the world who are increasing our download count a hell of a lot faster than we ever thought it would grow. I mean, Stu DeHaan, we just had a great conversation with Stu, Stephen Bradford Long, you know, Ada, Jack. Like I said, it's been great. And now
and
we
just
also
one special thanks.
Oh, go for it.
Yes. One special thanks to Miss Hassie Way, who, you know, from the very beginning of my journey has been an awesome source of education, you know, not just like sexually, but also satanically. And she actually did turn me on first to Sprinkle. And it's one of the key reasons we ended up, you know, this presentation and interview ended up transpiring. So thank you so much, Hassie. I love you. You're the most beautiful woman in the tri-state area. And that's a fact. It's not
Oh, my God. Yes. Now, don't forget to check out Satanic Study Hall's secondhand and virtual headquarters here for Lupercalia. We are hosting an ACE discussion panel on February 14th at 9 p.m. I'm sure you've heard it on social media. We had a great time recording that. There's super good stuff coming on February 14th. And I think the ACE community is going to be really happy with what some other members of the community put together on the panel and shared their thoughts with us. So really, that's about it. We have one more thing to take care of. So I'm going to say no Q&A. We're already over our time. Now, we hope you enjoyed Sex Ed 666. Who knows what we're going to do next time at the Satanic Estate. We kind of just figure things out on the fly. So I'm done. I think everybody else is done except for Father Al. Father Al is going to close out the evening with a Lupercalia invocation, and then we're going to hit the bell and class will be dismissed. Thank you all so much for being here. Father Al, it's all you.
And we just got a little message in from Principal Pan. Polly Ann, please report to Principal Pan's office immediately. Just letting you know.
Oh, shit.
All right. Hail yourself, fellow Satanists. Regardless of who you are, what you have done, or how your journey brought you here, rejoice for finding your way to our community. Hail yourself for embracing your sexuality, for it matters not whether you are prude or promiscuous. Your sexuality, as your identity, is your story to write. Hail yourself for identifying your personal gender, for only you can speak of who you are on the inside and express your true self externally. Hail yourself for respecting the bodily autonomy of others and for not denying the respect to others that you would expect others to give you. Hail yourself for practicing the self-discipline to control those carnal urges where embracing them would cause more harm to others than the satiation of those desires. Passion without discipline will surely lead to chaos. On this Lupercalia, we are reminded that bodily autonomy, sexual liberation, and reproduction aren't meant to be celebrated by single victories, but the ongoing struggle to improve ourselves and to live our satanic values daily. Hail yourself by loving yourself first, as you cannot achieve true happiness by relying on someone else to be your source of personal empowerment and fulfillment. Hail yourself by not sacrificing other living creatures to a false deity, but sacrificing your self-doubt, anxiety, fears, and other forces that are holding yourself back from being your true self to not only others around you, but to yourself. As now and as forever to come, hail yourself, hail those who are close to you, and hail Satan. Good night.
We love you all.
Happy Lupercalia.
Class is dismissed.